The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Victory for Manchester City in the Carabao Cup. Villa run them close, but it's 8 domestic trophies out of 9 for Pep as Phil Foden shines. Will he bring it home for England in the summer? In the Premier League, Liverpool lose a football match for the first time in over a year. Hammered 3-0 by Watford. How did it happen? Is it all Dejan Lovren's fault? Does anybody know the offside law? Everton have an injury time winner ruled out as Gylfi Sigurdsson sits on the floor. In the race for 4th or 5th, there's a big win for Wolves at Spurs, while at the bottom, West Ham and Norwich pick up important points. Elsewhere, Stevie G questions his own position at Rangers, Real win the Clasico, and the game stops in Germany because of a nasty banner. All that plus Inter Miami's inaugural game, Chelsea women get the first silverware of the season, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. We have a panel today. Kate Mason of Sky Sports News. How are you?
Well, I was tempted not to turn up today, Max, and to just send you my views so that you could perhaps read them out on the radio yourself.
Well, Barney Ronay is here.
Hi, Max. It's amazing you're still going. You were there speaking in my car on the way in. I know all the things you think already.
So. I've done 11 shows in 11 days, Barry Glendening. One with you, two with you.
Mm. Mm,
they were my two favourite.
Yeah, and two podcasts, so four really.
Oh, that's true, yes. I forget this doesn't feel like work because it's such a joy,
yeah.
Barry. Kate was alluding to the fact that on the WhatsApp group for the pod, you made a line, Kate. You had a good line about Nuno going to White Hart Lane.
It wasn't that good. The thing I'm upset about is it's not even my best material.
No. But you put it on the, you know, what was the line? Something along the lines of...
Well, you know, Max.
You know, can a Portuguese...
A wily Portuguese manager going to White Hart Lane to show everyone how it's done.
Exactly. So I used that. And Barney, you were listening on the rail and you outed me. And I...
As a joke
well,
thief.
I outed you privately on the WhatsApp
Yes,
group.
But then I felt bad about it. So I publicly apologised and I gave this podcast a lot of 10 minutes of airtime to the lot of us to apologise. And Barry didn't forgive me and said it was a bigger crime than some of the worst crimes there are. Right, Watford 3, Liverpool 0. Barry, you predicted a Watford victory.
I did, not with a huge amount of confidence, but... Liverpool have not been playing well since the winter break and they've been grinding out the results. And I just thought maybe on their day someone might beat them, you know, at home. Watford gave them a good pummeling on Saturday. They kind of bullied Liverpool, particularly Troy Deeney, Ismaila Sarr were outstanding. Dejan Lovren's been getting it in the neck. I don't think it was all his fault, but certainly his mistakes had a kind of knock-on effect, and Virgil van Dijk was trying to cover for his shortcomings, and that which led to shortcomings on the part of Virgil van Dijk. Trent Alexander-Arnold didn't have one of his better games, and they missed Jordan Henderson, I think, who, you know, among his the many qualities he brings to the party, it's sort of his leadership, and I think if he'd been on the pitch, he'd have been given a few rollickings to various players to up their game, but they just had a collectively very rare poor performance and suffered for it, and now their chances of, you know, having the invincible season, which I suspect no Liverpool fans or players are even remotely bothered about as long as they win the title, are gone. But yeah, it was sort of a kick up the arse for them.
In a way, it's a victory that reflects really well on a defeat that reflects well on Liverpool, because how on earth have they won all these games? I mean, you take a couple of players out, a couple of players have an off day, and suddenly they're eminently beatable by Watford. It reflects the kind of alchemy of that team, that you take Joe Gomez out and put the reserve centre back in Dejan Lovren, and they're not quite the same team. It's an incredible feat. I think one of Mourinho's best sort of jibes in recent times is when he said the two best teams in the Premier League were Manchester City A team and Manchester City B team. That's clearly not the case with Liverpool. What Klopp's done to get those players playing that well is an act of alchemy. And on their day, of course, they are beatable. I mean, it shows how well they've managed the details and what a sort of brilliant job that first 11 has done.
And actually, Kate, so impressive to be so motivated to win every football match. Well, until now.
Yeah, well, that could be part of the point. I mean, let's not forget how anonymous their famous front three were. Salah, Firmino, Mane, apparently not a single key pass and certainly no shots in that whole game. Obviously, they weren't getting that much service. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The absence of Joe Gomez. Who would have thought this was such a catalyst for disaster? And it was strange to see all of their defence playing so badly. Was it Trent Alexander-Arnold's pass that was just intercepted for the third goal? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then afterwards, they're all just standing about shouting at each other. And you're thinking, wow, Jesus, it's a very fine line between complete, you know, comfort and sticking together and disaster.
Did you like the bit where the ball just bounced over Lovren and Deeney? It was as though they had turned to stone. They were just stood, like Deeney had fixed him with this kind of destructor ray, and he literally stood completely still.
But actually, for that first goal, it is real basics that someone should be on the toes. Troy Deeney, you know, Troy Deeney is so strong because Lovren, it makes Lovren look completely useless. But actually, if you have someone in front of Troy Deeney, then that's the problem. And I think it was Alexander-Arnold that was out of position. Marcus says, I got into a bit of a Twitter spat with a guy who said us Liverpool fans were unwilling to blame Virgil van Dijk for the goals against Watford because he's Virgil van Dijk. But at least two were Lovren's fault because he tried to get into it with Deeney and forgot how to defend. I'm right, aren't I? Right.
Well, Deeney said afterwards, did you hear in the post-match, he said, you know, the whole game, Lovren just wanted to fight me. And I think if that is so obvious to the man you're up against, then you've already stolen a yard on him, haven't you, psychologically?
That's a bit like Scrappy Doo wanting, you know, to fight all these evil creatures that he's got no chance of beating, because Deeney really did bully him.
14 shots to Liverpool, 7, 5 of them on target compared to 1 for Liverpool. They made more tackles, won more balls in the air. They completed just under a third of the passes that Liverpool did, but created double the number of chances, more than double. What did Watford do that no one else has done this season?
Well, they played without any fear. I've often felt recently teams are slightly scared of Liverpool because you might get torn apart. And they pressed at the weak points that were there. One of the fun things about that Liverpool team is when they play together and the team interacts brilliantly, they look unstoppable. But there are weak points there. And I don't think Jurgen Klopp would pretend otherwise. And they were really surgical in it. And yeah, we'll dwell on the incredible manliness of Deeney. But it was a really good performance. Everybody played up to their level.
Liverpool fans taking it well on social media. Amelia Boner, February 29th isn't even a real day. Liverpool haven't lost a game on a legitimate calendar day. Fuck off with your daylight savings. You mentioned this Invincibles thing, and obviously Arsenal fans got very excited because they could cling on to being Invincibles. I mean, I guess that does matter to fans in a way, but
I mean, the whole thing's ridiculous, isn't it?
Just because Arsenal aren't very good at the moment, and I suppose it just gives people a chance to crow about something on Twitter.
They weren't invincible. I mean, they lost games, and towards the end of the season, they drew loads of games because they'd become obsessed with not losing any. I mean, that was a really good team. That was not the best of that Arsenal team. That Arsenal team were at times fantastic. Why should we pretend they're invincible and just remember that season? It seems a really odd thing to me.
Liverpool played Chelsea in the FA Cup. We presume Jurgen Klopp will play the kids again at Stamford Bridge. That is on Tuesday.
Alice? Do you think he will? I wouldn't think so.
I think
he might play some
mix,
of them.
A happy mix. Curtis Jones and Jordan Shaqiri.
No, I think he'll try and win the game. I mean, it's the FA Cup. Winning the double would be incredible for Liverpool. I hope not. Anyway, I'm going to that and I'm looking forward to it.
Okay.
Bearing that in mind, how come he's been playing the kids this whole time?
Well, you're getting to the sharp end of the season now. I mean, you might think, well, we can win this.
I think they should. Now, you go to that game. You also went to the Carabao Cup final. So many football matches you go to, Barney.
I know. It's part grueling, isn't it, for everyone involved?
Occupational hazard, I presume. Manchester City beat Aston Villa 2-1. Doug says, how many people are disappointed the Carabao box won't make an appearance on the pod? Villa almost, Barney, meant that we had a chance to see the Carabao box. It's fine margins when you play City. Everything has to go your way. There was that save from Bravo, which he probably should have made, but still a good save, pushing that head onto the post, and the corner that shouldn't have been a corner.
Yeah, the corner shouldn't have been a corner and also shouldn't have been so badly defended that you gave away such a soft goal. But I thought there was a weird moment in that game at 2-0 where everybody felt that the game was dead. And I think that transmitted slightly to the City players, who did let their levels drop a bit, and Villa came back, and it was turning into one of those days where you sort of question the point of football. That was going to be the thing, the takeaway from it, as City won 5-0. But thankfully that didn't happen, and Villa played really well, and it could have been 2-2 by the end. But I kind of, you know, you kind of felt where it was going the whole time, I thought. And Phil Foden played really well. I mean, I saw some people objecting to the idea that he played well and suggesting he kind of died away when Villa sort of pressed back towards the end of the game. But I didn't feel that. I felt he kept, given he doesn't play a lot on 90 minutes, you have to remember that it's a cup final and he is still a very young player. And he absolutely ran the game in the first half an hour. He is a real, I've been quite willing to buy into the idea of him as another sort of overhyped youngster. But whenever I've seen him, I've thought, God, he actually looks really good. And in that opening half hour, he properly a talent, really talented player.
He's so graceful, isn't he?
Yeah, the way he moves is extraordinary. He's physically has really progressed. He can pass and dribble and score. He's really good, and he should be. Looking at that team, he completely overshadowed the guy on the other wing, Raheem Sterling, who's had a bit of a dip, and to me seems to have lost a little bit of speed as well. I think he's probably quite tired. And Foden was fantastic.
So the question about Phil Foden is, does Gareth Southgate select him? Because if you look at who the England, you know, Jordan Henderson starts for England, and then you've got Winks, Rice, Mount, Barkley, Oxlade-Chamberlain, who am I forgetting? Ali, Madison. Yeah. I mean, they're all good players, but I don't know how many would get into the City squad.
He absolutely has to select
Foden. Grealish, of course. He has to select Foden.
Foden is an amazingly good footballer and is ideally suited to... I mean, international football is quite... it's either quite low quality or it's quite high quality but quite slow and technical. And he is suited to winning both those kinds of games. In the past, England have come up against... In the recent past, they've come up against quite technically good teams and not been able to keep the ball in midfield. And he is perfectly suited to playing that team. He's come through the level. He won't be scared of anything. I absolutely select him.
I mean, ex-pros will say, well, you can't pick him if he does not play in games.
Well, this is not true, is it? Of course you can pick him. He played a game yesterday and he was really good.
You're so convincing, Barney. I'm just totally convinced.
I find that a lot. I find that a lot with Barney. That
yeah, it's absolutely amazing.
I may have had a completely different opinion, but now
I've forgotten it, and I'm totally with him.
It's just some sort of noise. If you actually sort of, if you say something as though you're really certain of it, people kind of think it must be true.
Whereas when Barry has an opinion, I like the sound of his voice, but I can never remember what he's said.
Don't you?
Jesus Christ.
Some people saying, oh, look, VAR would take 10 seconds to... what are you doing with you?
I'm just like... Barney said this was the sort of the game that made him wonder what the point of football is. Was that what you said?
Initially, yeah.
Yeah. And I think if you're about to say we need VAR for corners, then I'm going to say that's the sort of point that makes me wonder what the point of football is.
Okay, I won't make it then.
Well, because it's just... It's just...
I agree with you. I agree with you, and they should defend it better. But if it only takes 5 seconds to say, that isn't a corner.
But would it take 5 seconds?
Exactly.
Right. It's sort of becoming this granular series of arguments.
It's a human game full of humans. I mean, the problem is slippery slope of VAR. Yeah. That's long. The horse bolted, stable, etc. The only thing that's good of the use of technology in football that no one seems to be fussed about is goal line technology. So I suppose you could make the argument probably that if the ball's... you'd have to have sensors or something on the players, wouldn't you, to decide if it had correctly gone out for a corner, which presumably actually is what will happen, because then you can judge offsides properly and you can decide where the nearest... You're looking at me like you just want me to stop.
No, you know, I'm listening. I'm listening and thinking of the next question.
I want you to stop.
Barry, Samatta's header, the best header at Wembley since Keith Houchin?
Ooh, that's a big shout. Yeah, maybe. I can't think of too many off the top of my head, you know, but certainly a good goal. The good folk of Tanzania will have enjoyed that.
They absolutely will have done.
Don Hutchison, was that at Wembley?
Was it at Wembley?
I think
Scotland
won,
against
they won,
England.
They won against Wembley, didn't they? That was a good header.
That was a good back across the keeper, if I remember it correctly. That was a good header.
It's a bit weird. That's the only header I can remember.
Samatta's the son of a retired policeman, I read, so perhaps he would be very unfavourable. Endless VAR.
Well, that's only if you... it depends what his relationship with his father is like. Because some people rebel, don't they?
Good point. You know, so he might
maybe he's
like
maybe
wacky.
He's a complete renegade because his dad, or unless his dad, of course, was a detective who didn't play by the rules and did a good job with a bad attitude. We don't know.
Amazing.
Pep's 8th domestic trophy out of 9. We should probably say that's quite good, Barry.
It is, yeah. Can I just say that I found the reaction to the fact that Villa didn't get tonked 9-0 slightly condescending. It's like they're being patted on the head, you know, well, you did your best and you didn't embarrass yourselves.
But it's just because of Watford, isn't it? It's because of the 6-0.
Yeah. Just.
But also the last time they played.
They got tonked.
Yeah. No, I think as a football fan, if you go and you watch a game that you lose, but you are sort of heroic in defeat, you do actually applaud your team off and you feel a pride.
I'm not saying they don't deserve credit, but I've just found the reaction from sort of neutrals to be a bit condescending. Maybe it isn't and I'm just being oversensitive, but if I was a Villa player or a Villa fan, I think I'd be a bit miffed by this patronising praise my team is getting, because the fact of the matter is they lost.
Does anyone think it's time for Noel Gallagher to stop going to the Manchester City dressing room?
Yes, he doesn't seem to have had enough of it, and I really think he probably should just give it a break, because every single time he does it, which is every time, yeah, we have to put him relentlessly in the kind of wrap of what's happened on Sky. I mean, it gives people a chance to do puns based on songs. Mm, so that's quite nice.
Players might like it, I guess.
What do you think the players secretly say about him?
What, when he's gone?
Yeah, like when he comes again. That bloke.
I reckon
I don't
they
think
say
that was a song.
They comment on the fact that he's really small and that.
Is he?
He looks, yeah, he's much smaller in real life than you'd think.
Like people on telly?
Yeah.
If you were manager of Sunderland, Barry, and you're in the dressing room, which band would you bring in, which singer to celebrate alongside for the bants as your kit man sailed across the floor in his pants?
I'd probably, I don't know. Does there have to be a Sunderland fan?
No. That narrows it down. Who are the famous Sunderland fans? Jonathan Wilson?
Jonathan Wilson.
You get him in.
Yes. In the States, people like Rihanna show up to watch basketball.
Okay.
Why can't we?
Might get Rihanna in.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
From Grace Note, that was the first League Cup final to feature goal scorers from 3 different continents, South America, Europe and Africa. Manchester City go to Hillsborough on Wednesday in the FA Cup. One more game to get through in part one at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Tottenham 2, Wolves 3. Kate, you were there with your mum.
I was. My mother is a Wolves fan, you see. Certainly someone got some unalloyed joy out of the day. I actually quite enjoyed this game. I mean, 5 goals. I thought we started really well. So I went to see the RB Leipzig game at the Tottenham Stadium and I was sitting behind our goal for the first half. And it was just an onslaught. It was a massive onslaught. Tottenham didn't seem to be able to put a stop to any Leipzig attacks. It's extraordinary that game finished 1-0. So I was actually pretty scared. Especially as my mum, like, obviously loves a crow if she, you know, yeah, Wolves win. So I was pretty scared about this game. I thought it would be 2-0, possibly 3-0 Wolves. I was also very scared about the idea of Adama Traore up against Jan Vertonghen trying to match pace between those two players, which would have been impossible. So I know a lot of people had issues with the Mourinho team selection, but I actually thought it was a pretty good decision. He said afterwards, you know, I chose what Sanchez and Tanganga because they have the greatest pace and that was what I was trying to do. Yeah, I think it was a decent idea and it almost works. And there were a couple of individual errors that led to goals. And Dele Alli had, 3 or 4 chances that he, on other day, would have made.
How come your mum is Wolves and you are Tottenham?
So my mother is from Wensfield, even though she speaks like the Queen.
Okay.
But where I was brought up was too far away from Wolverhampton.
I've been very critical of Jose, especially how he just was playing dirty long ball to Bergwijn and Moura in the last couple of games. I actually thought Tottenham tried to play football in this game and it could have gone either way, and Wolves are just a more incisive team.
Yeah, and I really think, this is sort of a broader point, but I'm a bit nervous for Tottenham because of this negative Mourinho. Mourinho's come in, he's a negative manager, he's going to destroy everything. And I've been guilty of thinking that myself, especially this idea of like trashing the legacy of Pochettino. But you know, the situation is as it is and you need to give him a chance. And I think maybe even Barney pointed out fairly recently, you know, he hasn't had the chance to have a full pre-season. there's time to go. But if the fans are, I mean, because Wolves fans famously have strong voices and good at celebrating, and they were singing in the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, and my God, that place has got an incredible acoustic, and it was just so loud and impassioned. And then compare it to the rest of the stand, I mean, almost throughout, it just was silent.
Which acoustic is better out of Covent Garden, the Opera House, and
I mean, an argument definitely could be made that the new White Hart Lane acoustic is better, because if you stand too far back on the stage, it doesn't project.
I mean, it's interesting that Spurs have played Leipzig and Wolves in the last two games, because those are two hugely coherent teams under sort of thrusting young managers who've had time to make everything work. And I mean, if you just look at the Tottenham team on the paper, does it look like a team that should be beating Wolves? Not really, to be honest. I know people will object and say there was a better selection, but sometimes you do have to trust, like Kay says, you do have to trust managers with selection, and quite right. A lot of those Spurs defenders are incredibly slow, and imagine how they would have been taken apart by a Wolves attack. I also think it's quite funny that I thought Spurs played quite well as well. Mourinho has sort of given Spurs back their Spurs. They were brittle, flaky. They threw away a lead and lost at home. It's like the old Spurs. Fans are always saying, give us our Arsenal back.
I can't believe he lured me into agreeing before he made the point.
He's given back your Spurs.
This is the Tottenham way.
Thanks, mate.
It's Jose Spurs, you know, a flaky, kind of fairly nice team, lost at home after leading. So you've got your team back in the new stadium. Everything's right with the world.
Third goal was lovely. Jota was superb for that, and a lovely finish from him.
But Max, there were muted celebrations.
Oh, why?
Because of VAR.
Oh, no, I quite liked that, actually.
The muted celebrations.
Yeah. Well, they weren't actually that muted. Oh, I feel as though everyone... What was quite cool about this VAR thing in the stadium that I haven't seen before is that everyone still goes mental. Everyone's, like, delighted and ecstatic. And then there's this, like, everyone's looking around. Does anyone have more information about whether this is going to be a goal?
Can we cheer again?
So double,
and then kick off, and then they...
Double cheers.
Yeah, I actually quite liked it.
They couldn't stop Traore, even with all that...
No shoulder.
...pace. Say again?
No shoulder. He's got real problems with his shoulder, and he had to go off eventually.
Yes, well, I wondered if Tanganga had become a superhero and put his hand on his shoulder, and all that power had gone to Traore. But Wolves had played on Thursday night as well and didn't change their side massively. Huge fan of Adama Traore's factual post after that game, which was a picture of him, and it just said, "We are now into the Europa League last 16. There was another one when they drew at Manchester United, and it had a picture of Adama Traore, and it just went, "Stalemate at Old Trafford." Unfortunately, a bit more emotion after this game. Great job by the whole team to get the win against a great opponent. High points for Tottenham. Aurier did kick the ball with his left foot, I think for the first time I've ever seen it.
And it was absolutely amazing. It was a great goal.
And it went in. Jonathan Veal from PA on the subject of Serge Aurier writes, "A funny and telling line from Serge Aurier in the programme. Quote, when I was young, I didn't want to play right back. I started to play right back at 17 or 18, where my manager put me there. I cried because I didn't want to do it." He did okay yesterday, didn't he?
Yeah, let's have a moment for Serge Aurier.
Whenever anyone says Serge Aurier, I think of Serge Aurier. I imagine a cartoon character with that little beard as well. He's Serge Aurier, like a cartoon mouse who runs up and down, gets very excited, very sad, does spectacular things.
But a knight of the realm.
Absolutely. He's sort of noble as well. Yeah. He's galloping on his horse.
Noble Serge Aurier.
Serge Aurier.
It was quite cartoonish the way that he, after scoring that, frankly, great goal cutting inside from distance, he celebrated by sliding on his knees, and then he did kind of fall. Well, you could make out that he was deliberately trying to do that, but he did kind of then fall over onto his face at the
failed
end of his
knee slide.
Well, because the knees didn't slide.
Not far enough.
When footballers do that, I'm always struck by how incredibly athletic footballers are. If you were to do that, I mean, you'd absolutely ruin both your knees, but these guys can incorporate a roll.
I think I had a habit of doing it at weddings back in the day. I can't do it now.
Did you have your tie around your head, Rambo style?
100%. But I had my knee support on as well. That'll do for part one. Part two will begin with a deep dive into the offside law at Goodison Park. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly live shows, March the 9th and 10th, up in Scotland, Glasgow University debating chambers. Still a few tickets remaining. Damn you, William Shatner. Buy them, please. Sold out in Edinburgh, the Pleasance. 23rd of March, Earth in Hackney. 9th of April, back in Leeds. Lineups TBC. Right to Goodison. Everton 1, Manchester United 1. We'll get on to whether either goalkeeper is worthy of being a goalkeeper in a second. Let's start with the incident in injury time, Dominic Calvert-Lewin takes a shot. It's deflected off Harry Maguire. Gylfi Sigurdsson is sitting on the floor. It sort of goes past his legs. Arguably, if he'd stayed totally still, it may not have touched his legs. VAR disallows the goal for offside. Were they right, Barry?
I thought so. And then I was slightly baffled to see in one of the papers this morning that refereeing's Mark Clattenburg thought it should have been allowed. So
Halsey, Walton and Hackett say it should have been offside. And Clattenburg said it should have been given.
Well, there you go.
I mean, it obviously was offside. I mean, you're playing a game of football. And omission is still an action. You're still doing something by not doing something. When you deliberately don't do something, you're still deliberately doing something. I mean, it's not really even a debate, is it? I found it quite empowering in a weird kind of way, in that Gylfi Sigurdsson was deemed to be taking part in a game of football even while he was sitting down. And if you think that 99% of the people who watch, enjoy, have opinions on football are essentially doing what Gylfi Sigurdsson's doing, like sitting down on the fringes of the action, I think it's great for all of us that he was deemed to be involved in the game.
Was it a penalty? I mean, Wan-Bissaka absolutely takes Sigurdsson out after he strikes the ball. Now, quite often fouls aren't given if you get your shot away. But the only reason he's sitting there is because he's been kicked over in the box. So really, VAR should have said, before the offside decision even made, that is a penalty for Everton.
Well, that's just more endless rewinding. It's probably right. I mean, you're not allowed to kick people. But as you know, I'm deeply concerned about all the dead football that hasn't actually happened. And at what point do we stop rewinding life and accept that?
I mean, that is only rewinding forward half a second before, isn't it?
Yeah, but we've got two incidents to look at there. Was there another incident before that we should look at too that would stop those two incidents also happening? What if one of those incidents in the middle was okay, but the one at the beginning was? I mean, how does the chain of events work? It's very confusing.
Yeah, was the kickoff for the second half, was that definitely correctly carried out?
Well, there was a social media meltdown, obviously, and it turned out that all Everton fans thought it should have been given as a goal, and all Manchester United fans thought it should have been disallowed. But
you need to read Twitter to find that out.
Amidst the meltdown, my favourite tweet was from Adam Hickin, who said, "I missed the whole game because of the cushion in my line of sight." He placed the cushion on the floor with the TV in the way, suggesting that David De Gea can see Calvert-Lewin kicking the ball.
The real analogy there, that wouldn't be a cushion. It would be another television showing a different game, which then moves at the crucial moment, distracting you. You'd say that television is interfering with my enjoyment of this game.
There's an interesting point, which is, Calvert-Lewin was shown the footage afterwards and he was spitting feathers. And then Michael Keane said, "We were robbed. VAR's robbed us again." And this is just proof that footballers don't all know the laws of football. And that didn't surprise me that they didn't know.
I think to some extent we are to blame, or the anthropomorphisation of VAR is to blame, in the sense that the headline often, or the line often, is denied by VAR. It's
but
not
VAR
what it
is a thing. I saw there was the other day, I think it was the Lo Celso. Was it that sending off where they said it was it wasn't human error, it was VAR error?
No, they said the opposite.
They said it was human
error.
Yeah,
they did, yeah.
It wasn't VAR error.
Well, VAR...
But that doesn't make sense either way, because VAR is a video assistant referee, which is a human.
I think the point they were trying to make was that the tech itself, like the cameras and all that sort of... Because people think there's loads of wizardry behind VAR, but there isn't any wizardry at all. It's just camera angles like you see on telly.
I've been there. It's full of wizards. Richard Jolly's tweet of the day: Carlo Ancelotti has had as many red cards in the Premier League as Robbie Savage. That was petty from Chris Kavanagh, wasn't it, Baz?
I thought Chris Kavanagh had a poor game. He was never really in control of it. And yeah, it was petty, but Carlo Ancelotti was arguing a point, I suspect. In the cold light of day, he will go, that was offside.
Before that, goalkeepers, Roy Keane was pretty understated at half-time on Sky. He said, for the De Gea mistake, where he just waited for ages and then punted it at Calvert-Lewin, I would have lynched him. And as of Pickford, he said, of not saving Bruno Fernandes' strike, he's not a very good goalkeeper.
Look, Jordan Keeper... Jordan Keeper. Jordan Pickford.
He was always going to play in that position, wasn't he, Jordan Keeper?
Jordan Pickford is not having a particularly good season. And that's two matches in a row now that Gareth Southgate has been there to see him, A, make a pretty bad mistake, and B, sort of redeem himself by making a really good save later in the game. And we saw the best and worst of both Pickford and David De Gea yesterday. If I was an England fan, I would be very concerned about going to the Euros with Jordan Pickford as first-choice goalkeeper. But to state that he's no good is nonsense.
Up to Joe saying, since Carlo Ancelotti's first game in charge of Everton on Boxing Day, Dominic Calvert-Lewin has scored more Premier League goals than any other player. And, you know, worth pointing out the impact that Bruno Fernandes has had at Manchester United. You know, if you get the right people in the right places, it makes such a big difference. And he's a tremendous
footballer.
He seems
to be really enjoying it as well, doesn't he? He's obviously desperate to play in that kind of place and with those kind of players, which is quite nice to see.
It is. In the Europa League, Manchester United were given a huge helping hand when Club Brugge had a player sent off after 22 minutes. It was a brilliant handball because he dived exactly the same time as Simon Mignolet behind him and did exactly the same save Simon Mignolet would have done, but he's an outfield player. And then the referee went and looked at the monitor for about 25 minutes, I think just because he thought it was funny and wanted to see it again and again and again. Anyway, they went on to win 5-0. Igalo scored his first goal in a United shirt. They will now play LASK, top of the Austrian Bundesliga, in the next round. And they've got Derby in the FA Cup on Thursday. Wayne Rooney versus Manchester United. To Carrow Road, Norwich 1, Leicester 0. Very impressive from Norwich. What a strike from Jamal Lewis. Max Aaron's first assist of the season. Lewis's first ever goal. And a joyous camera angle. From the reverse angle, seeing the ball, it's just going wide and it curls into the corner. Does this mean Norwich have a glimmer of hope, Barry?
Yeah, it's kind of become a thing to describe them as the best worst team in Premier League history. And I don't think they are the worst team in the Premier League, but they are bottom. It is unlikely that they will escape relegation, but it's not unthinkable. Teams have done it before. Teams got out of bigger pickles than they're in, Sunderland among them. I'd quite like to see them stay up, to be honest, but yeah, I'd give them maybe a 15% chance.
What about Leicester? One win in seven, Barney. Lost their last two. They have an 8-point lead on fifth. Are you worried that they'll drop off completely?
Well, I've been waiting for this moment. My only note, as you know, was Leicester's enormous cushion.
Feel you were upstaged by the guy on Twitter who had the picture of his enormous cushion blocking his view of the television?
That's true. Although his cushion was also sort of smaller than it might have been to make the point he was trying to make. And perhaps Leicester are feeling less benefit from their enormous cushion. It's sort of shrinking. It's becoming bedded down. The stuff inside is leaking out. If you've been to Leicester's club shop, they do have, it's a massive club shop, and they have stuff coming through repeatedly, new things, different player, different promotion. They should have the enormous cushion. probably there'd be a run on them now, but they do seem to have run out of steam a bit.
How big will the cushion be by the end of the season, Barney? Become a flannel or like a little...
Well, this is the remaining note of tension in the Premier League, isn't it? Who's going to join the top two in the Champions League? It all depends on getting Ndidi back playing regularly, who is brilliant, and whether Vardy can start scoring again. I suspect Vardy needed a rest.
Missed quite a few games as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, recently. He needed a proper rest and didn't get one, and that's affected them.
Interesting side point, actually, on the qualification for the Champions League. UEFA, by all accounts, absolutely terrified that it'll be Leicester, Sheffield United and Wolves and not any of the so-called bigger clubs because of broadcasting, just the figures that they'll get compared to if Manchester United get in. Not that that should bother the fans of any of those teams.
Should have banned that team, should they?
God, would that presage the end of the Champions League generally?
Who knows? Ian Acho had a goal disallowed. Brendan Rodgers said, "We are disappointed with our goal being ruled out. We felt it was very, very harsh. It was unintentional, but it hits their player's arm and drops onto Kelechi's." That is literally the law, though, Brendan. I mean, he may think the law is harsh, but it is what it is at the moment. Jofra Archer tweeted, "Not sure about VAR." Someone replied to him to ask, "You actually watching football? Crazy." To which he replied, "I'm taking a break from Call of Duty to eat." So that's nice for Jofra. Leicester play Birmingham on Wednesday in the FA Cup. To the Vitality, Bournemouth 2, Chelsea 2. Point not particularly useful for either side. Bournemouth slip into the relegation zone. Chelsea just 3 points clear now of 5th and 6th. Manchester United and Wolves. Lampard saying afterwards, I'm very happy for Marcus Alonso, who scored 2. But when I think that my left back is the one scoring the goals, and he scored our last goal in the league as well, and you're creating that many chances in between, you have to question why we're not finishing them. It's same old story for Chelsea, isn't it, Baz?
Like you say, a point's not much use to either of them. Both teams will see it as 2 points dropped, probably. And Frank Lampard's doing okay. I suspect there'll be a massive overhaul in the summer. And
yeah. Do you think there'll be a massive overhaul?
What sort of overhaul?
I suspect he has quite a few players that he wants to get rid of, and clearly quite a few more that he wants to bring in. Ergo, an overhaul.
Okay.
But whether or not he will, you know, be able to get all his ducks in a row to a manner in which pleases him remains to be seen.
How many players constitutes an overhaul for you?
I'd say 5 or 6. Mm. Out.
Who's out? Who's going?
I'd say Alonso's going. Azpilicueta's going.
The goalkeeper?
Yeah, definitely. He clearly doesn't rate him.
Pedro's off.
Kante.
Cash in on Kante.
Do you think? Maybe. You've put me on the spot now.
Willian?
Willian.
Willian will stay, will he?
Oh, I think so.
He's going to go to Tottenham now.
Do you want that to happen?
Yeah.
Okay.
Giroud, I'd imagine, would leave.
This is an oval.
God, we're up to about 6 now. 7.
How many players left? but they've got to have some experience. I mean, if you get rid of all of that, you do need experience. I know we sort of talk about Chelsea if they're an under-11 side and they're not, but which is a line I think I stole from you, Barney, just to be clear about these things. you've got to have some experience.
You have to have some experience of playing for Chelsea, or just some experience?
You can buy experience.
Well,
true. But it's expensive buying experienced players, isn't it?
Do you think, therefore, that Frank Lampard continually changing formation and playing his squad differently suggests, therefore, that he's more that he's not happy with it than that he doesn't have a plan?
I think he's just... Well, I mean, he got the job. He wasn't allowed to bring any players in during the summer. Antonio Rudiger, another one I suspect will go.
Wow.
But
you're so brutal, Barry. Swinging your
yeah, so it's I think whatever Frank Lampard did this season, unless it was a complete and utter disaster, which it hasn't been, he was always going to be given the benefit of the doubt and given a full summer to chop and change as he sees fit, and we shall see.
We shall. Chelsea play Liverpool on Tuesday, as we've mentioned. To the Amex, Brighton 0, Crystal Palace 1. Huge win for Palace in Roy's 100th game in charge. Should we praise Christian Benteke for doing something good, Barney?
Yeah, he's had a rough ride, hasn't he? I mean, he does win a huge amount of headers, but they often seem to be pointless headers. Or teams just allow him to win headers because him winning a header is not a source of threat. And he seems quite a sort of gentle, nice man as well. So, happy for him.
It's pointless headers is the show that Richard Osman and Xander Armstrong will make just after pointless celebrities goes out. A selection of target men just heading the ball. 24 shots for Brighton, their most ever in a Premier League game. And they had their chances, and scoring goals is a huge problem for them. Ian writes, where does the Ezequiel Schelotto beef with Zaha rank on the shithousery scale? Schelotto booked when he wasn't even on the pitch, which I always think is very impressive, Kate.
Yeah, but shithousery, I suppose it's more impressive if you manage to incense someone who's less obviously easily incensed, I would say.
Oh, right, I see. Zaha's an easy target for shithousery. Where should Schelotto be aiming? If he wants the calmest footballer. Who is the calmest footballer?
Milner?
You think James Milner is unshithousable? Is that the word?
You're in charge.
Okay, yes. Well, let's see if we can make it happen.
But the thing was, Schelotto more or less rendered himself unusable by getting that yellow card, because he would have been marking Zaha if he'd had to come on. Already on a yellow card with ongoing beef. So yeah, it was not the brightest.
More importantly, as we've mentioned before, Barry, Schilotto is the Premier League player who looks most like a pirate.
Correct.
And for that, he deserves some congratulations.
You think the yellow card should be rescinded because of that?
Absolutely, yeah. He should have to mark Troy Parrott. That's when football will have peaked. 16 of Crystal Palace's 28 Premier League games this season have been goalless at half-time. At least 5 more than any other side. So really, if you are a Palace fan, you just don't have to go until the second half.
The funny thing is, I discovered, who's the Norwegian striker who is on loan from Palace at Trabzonspor?
Sorloth?
Yes. He's absolutely banging them in for fun this season. I think he's got about 26 goals and 9 or 10 assists for Trabzonspor, who are top of the table in Turkey.
Turns out the Premier League is quite high quality.
Producer Jonathan points out that Lars said this on the podcast weeks ago to you. So it's not just me that steals.
I don't remember. I discovered this. I'd completely forgotten that and then was surprised to notice when I was writing the rumour mill this morning.
Oh, interesting. West Ham 3, Southampton 1. Great win for West Ham. Fantastic performance from Jared Bowen. Jacob Steinberg tweeting, the lazy caricature of Moyes as a dinosaur meant people wrongly jumped on that quote about Bowen not being a saviour. He was keeping the pressure off and the patient approach worked. Great goal from Bowen on his first start. Is Jacob right about Moyes? Because I have in my mind he's part of the dinosaur club.
I mean,
which is a kids' club I want to start with, Alan Dyson and David Moyes.
It is a caricature. I mean, I don't think that you should dismiss people based on their age, nationality, and that includes being an old Scottish manager. It could be that you have something interesting to say. And I agree with Jacob about his take on Bowen. He obviously knows he's a good player, but he doesn't want him to have to come in as a sort of saviour. I thought the finish was brilliant. I thought it was quite interesting because Premier League players are these incredible athletes. I don't know what they're doing to themselves exactly. You know, when you stand next to a Premier League player, even a big, burly Premier League player, they're incredibly lithe. Mm. I remember standing next to Per Mertesacker and there's nothing of him. He's looked quite small, even though he's the big German, but he's just pure muscle. And Bowen hasn't been through that yet. He looks like a championship player. And there is a difference. And you could see him moving around the pitch. He'll get quicker and fitter, hopefully. And I think he'll be a really good player. He's really skillful.
Also, Jacob saying Mikel Antonio was unplayable. And he was brilliant. LD says, was Haller's goal for West Ham this weekend the most Sunday League goal ever? It had a lot of fun in it, challenging the keeper and then just slide tackling it in. But look, a huge win for West Ham, and they really needed that,
yeah,
didn't they? Newcastle 0, Burnley 0. Christian says, would you rather watch a loop of Newcastle-Burnley or the last 15 minutes of Hoffenheim-Bayern, which we'll get on to? I'm not sure anyone thought this was going to be a classic. Match of the Day sent a commentator, Guy Mowbray, who'd basically lost his voice before the game had even started. Newcastle play West Brom in the FA Cup.
Literally the only thing I've got about this is that reading, I think, The Athletic, Sean Dyche supposedly says to his players they need to have hearts on fire, heads in the fridge. What do we make of that?
Well, having heads in the fridge is sort of sign of a serial killer, isn't it? not your own head, obviously. Someone else's head.
Hearts in the fire, heads in the fridge. It's a film I wouldn't watch.
Yeah.
I'll be honest.
It sounds a bit of a slasher flick. The only sort of interesting thing about that game was I kind of feel sorry for Steve Bruce because Newcastle have been struggling to score. He's been getting it in the neck for only playing one up front. This time he played Joe Ellington on the left and brought in Dwight Gale, so he had two up front and it still couldn't score. So he's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't.
Portsmouth play Arsenal tonight in the FA Cup. Arsenal went out of the Europa League last Thursday. Richard Jolly, again, this will be the first year since 1999 that Arsenal did not play European football in March. They lost 2-1 to Olympiacos, 1-0 down after 90 minutes. Aubameyang scored this beautiful overhead volley to put them in charge in extra time. Then they imploded in the last minute. Leno giving away a corner for no reason, conceding that goal, and Aubameyang still having the chance to win it.
Yeah, it was painful, wasn't it?
Wasn't it?
It was one of those games, I thought, where you look at the away fans and that sort of weird collective. I know how this game's going to go. I knew those fans would be leaping around celebrating at the end because they just looked so obsessed with the idea that was going to happen. I felt for Aubameyang. He was clearly distraught at the end. But
you can't blame him. I mean, he's so crucial to Arsenal, isn't he?
They just don't... The defence is just not very good. And in the end, someone was going to take advantage of that.
I have a couple of Arsenal season ticket holding buddies who just didn't bother going to that game. Just couldn't be arsed. And I think they were far from the only ones if the sight of the stands was anything to go by. And the Olympiacos fans really gave it socks from an hour before the game till long after the game.
In the Championship, West Brom's unbeaten run ends at 6 games. They lost 1-0 to Wigan until very recently were struggling. They're down in 19th, but top of the form table for the last 8 games. Leeds and Fulham both won. Leeds tonked struggling Hull 4-0 in the first game of Kiko Casilla's 8-match ban. He's been suspended by the FA for racially abusing Charlton's Jonathan Lecco during a game in September. The FA haven't released their written reasons yet, but will do this week. Leeds released a statement to say, "We would like to make it clear we do not tolerate any form of discrimination within our football club. We are a leader in the fight against discrimination and within our wider community. However, it is important to recognise Kiko has always denied making any racist comment. The FA panel has based its decision on the balance of probability rather than proving Kiko to be guilty beyond reasonable doubt, which we have always believed is the more appropriate burden of proof." Fulham beat fellow playoff contenders Preston 2-0. 5th played 11th, 7th played 10th, 8th played 9th. They all drew. Middlesbrough play Forest tonight, would climb out of the relegation zone with a win. But you know, the fact they're in a relegation zone shows how much Jonathan Woodgate's side are struggling. In League One, leaders Coventry beat your mob Barry 1-0. The only goal of the game coming in the second minute. Rotherham in second drew, while Portsmouth won to jump into third, just 3 points off the automatic places. AFC Wimbledon won 2-1 away at Gillingham to put some daylight between them and the relegation zone. Callum Riley put away their winner in the 91st minute after absolute beautiful Sunday league football for that one. And in League Two, Swindon stay top by a point despite their game at Mansfield being called off for a waterlogged pitch. Crewe missed the chance to take the lead as they drew at struggling Morecambe, 4 points between first and fifth. Oldham had the biggest win of the weekend. They beat Newport 5-0, whilst Cambridge, still without a permanent manager, lost 2-1 at home to Carlisle. The Continental Cup final, Chelsea beat Arsenal 2-1 in an exciting game. Beth England put Chelsea ahead in the 8th minute after some sloppy defending. Arsenal had the better of it for most of the game. The pressure finally telling in the 85th minute with a Leah Williamson equaliser. But before they could get into extra time, Beth England popped up with the winner. Kate, she's a tremendous player, Beth England, isn't she?
She is fantastic. I mean, the great bit of skill in that move, although it was a good team effort, really, was Sam Kerr doing a kind of Adama Traore up the right-hand side. Victoria Schneiderbeck of Arsenal had been holding her off for much of the game, but that was, Beth England said afterwards that she didn't want it to go to anything further because she didn't have any legs left. Joe Montemiro, Arsenal boss, only able to name 5 substitutes for the final, as in he doesn't have a big enough squad to put out a full side. Emma Hayes. So this is the first time Chelsea have won this tournament. And in the past, she's called for the competition to be scrapped. She says it disrupts the league season. She may have a point also because I've been doing this hopefully quite interesting chat with a woman called Maggie Murphy, who is the general manager of Lewis Football Club. They pay their men's and women's team the same. Anyway, that's something going up on Sky this week in the conversation about the pay disparity in football. So the winners of the Continental Cup get £6,500, which is about...
That's astonishing. It's the League Cup, right?
It's the League Cup, Although actually, League Cup, surprisingly small prize money. It's £100,000 for the men's teams, which I didn't realise. But the FA Cup, because of course that's coming up this week, if you're in the Women's FA Cup semi-finals, you win the princely sum of £5,000. And if you're the men's semi-finalists, you win £1.8 million, which is I haven't actually done this maths. This is Maggie's maths. But she says it's 0.29% of what the men get. And I know, of course, you can talk about sponsorship. You can talk about historical inequality. You can talk about, what would happen if we were to split up the men's prize money because, would they be able to run if they were to have half as much prize? If you were to say split the prize money equally for the FA Cup. But the fact is, back in 2018, the men's prize money in the FA Cup was doubled. So,
and actually,
two years ago, they had half as much prize money, and everything was fine.
But there was that story that the England women's team aren't chartering a plane, a flying premium economy, I think, for the She Believes Cup.
Yeah,
they've already gone. So.
Right. So, well, they went premium economy. I mean, that's the disparity is there. I mean, do you think it should be totally equal?
It's a difficult argument to make. I'm not trying to say men and female footballers should at this point be paid the same amount, but I am, I suppose, trying to say in the situation where a quasi-governmental organisation like the FA has the opportunity to up prize money and to have a real impact on a game, I don't think it's the funds are necessarily better used doubling the men's prize money.
I mean, what they would say is they doubled the men's prize money because nobody cares about their cup, and that they were trying to get, they weren't trying to reward the men for being great men, they're trying to semaphore their own relevance, is what they would say, I guess. But I agree with you. I mean, why not? Why do that? You
know? Well, the Finnish FA has announced it will be changing the name of their top women's league from Women's League to National League. Finnish FA president Ari Lahti said, "People come to the games to see top athletes play quality football. That is why women's football should be treated equally with men's football. The Finnish FA is one of the few in the world who pay their men's and women's national teams the same." Fitbar Corner, Barry.
Yes. Could we all pause for a moment to sympathise with Steven Gerrard, who's having something of an existential crisis following his Rangers team, arguably had their best result of the season on Wednesday when they got past Braga into the next round of the Europa League, where they will face Bayer Leverkusen, and then followed that up on Saturday by getting dumped out of the Scottish Cup by Hearts, who are the bottom place team. Steven Gerrard is not happy. Alfredo Morelos obviously grabbing headlines again, despite the fact that he didn't actually feature in the squad. And the reason he wasn't in the squad, he was left out as punishment because he was suspended for the Braga game. So Gerrard gave him permission to go home to Colombia to deal with some family matter or other. And he arrived back a day late. So he was left out of the squad, despite the fact that Jermaine Defoe wasn't fit enough to start, and Florian Kamberi was cup-tied and couldn't play either. So Steven Gerrard was very short up front. They lost 1-0 in a game that was, the officiating was, even by Scottish standards, really bad. But Gerrard didn't blame the ref, and he said afterwards, "I'm feeling pain right now because I want to win here. I'm desperate to win here. Looking from the side today, I didn't get the impression that the feeling amongst my players was the same. I'm not doubting myself. We've given these players everything. Me and my staff have given these players absolutely everything for 20 months, held their hand on and off the pitch and improved everything for them. But it's tough when every other performance you feel the way you feel. It is tough. I need to analyse myself for sure. This is the toughest moment I've had since I've come here." And he said he was going to take a couple of days to think about stuff, fueling speculation that he might quit. But I don't think that's going to happen. I'd imagine when he's had time to reflect, he'll realise that they've a Europa League tie against Bayer Leverkusen to prepare for, and I expect him to be back in the dugout for their game against Hamilton on Wednesday in the Scottish Premiership. Although if they lose that, then he really have that'll be serious crisis time.
I mean, they've got Leverkusen, then Celtic, then Leverkusen, and you sort of think their whole season is the Europa League, but you can't rest players for the old firm, can you? But he probably should.
Yeah, but I mean, they're not going to win the Europa League.
You never know, eh?
They're already punching above their weight. But anyway, elsewhere in the Scottish Cup, Hibs beat Inverness. Aberdeen beat St Mirren, Celtic beat St Johnstone. So its semi-finals are Celtic Aberdeen, Hearts Hibs, and that was Celtic's win over St Johnstone was their 34th consecutive domestic cup tie win.
Well done to them, although they were knocked out of the Europa League, weren't they, by FC Copenhagen on Thursday night. So
Rangers, that is correct.
The only Scottish side left in that competition. Right, that'll do for part two. We'll start part three with Sid in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. We'll begin in Spain with Sid Lowe. Hello, Sid Lowe.
Hello, how are you?
I'm really well. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks.
Excellent. El Clasico ended then 2-0 to Real Madrid. A deserved victory?
Yeah and no. Shall I use the cliche of a game of two halves? It was a game of two halves. It was a weird one as well, because it was two halves and two totally different approaches to it. So Barcelona tried to slow the game down, keep possession, make sure they dominated and controlled in that sense. And then actually, in fairness to them, did find that they created, I think, three really clear chances in the first half. And then when the game tilted, and this is obviously based on the feeling inside of the stadium, and I don't know if from elsewhere it kind of looked different, but in the stadium at least, it felt like an emotional tilt more than necessarily a kind of a purely footballing one. And it felt like it tilted with an Isco shot that Ter Stegen saves, and the whole stadium kind of went, "Wow, okay, this is it." And then then Madrid just kind of blew at Barcelona and pushed them back and quickened the pace of the game, and Barca couldn't live with it. So in the end, yeah, I think it was deserved.
Were either side any good? Are either of these two sides that good?
That's a very good question, Max. I sort of can't properly come up with a really good answer for you, because in patches there were good things there, but I think there's definitely something in what Jorge Valdano had said, and he'd said this, by the way, before the game, you know, not just after it, and I think the game kind of bore this out up to a point. He said, you know, the Clásico this year feels like a race between two men with a limp. You know, there's something not quite right. They're not what they should be. And I think that's certainly true, that Barcelona kept possession very well, but then collapsed incredibly quickly and incredibly easily, and didn't really have the edge and the kind of the incision that they should have. Madrid responded with kind of a very physical, very emotional, very quick and very dynamic approach. But again, it feels like there's some of the qualities not there. And I must admit, the truth is, and obviously we could be proven wrong because it's happened before, but you sort of look at these two teams now and you think, yeah, they're probably not good enough to win the Champions League, either of them, even though obviously there's a lot of good players in there. And it does feel like neither of them are quite right. And certainly Messi, and this is one of the curious things about it, Messi himself doesn't look right at all.
Sevilla and Getafe both won. They make up the rest of the top four. Atleti dropped to fifth. They drew again. 11 draws now. The fight for those Champions League places will be very tight, won't it?
Yeah, well, it's going to be quite exciting because, I say exciting. In a way, exciting because it's driven by teams not being quite good enough. But that does at least open it up to others, because you've got, you know, you've just mentioned Atletico, Sevilla, Getafe. There's also Real Sociedad, who I think will consider themselves. I personally think they're, in terms of the way they play, at least the third best team in Spain at the moment. And actually, in terms of how they play as against expectation, I think they're better than Madrid and Barcelona as well. So yeah, it could be a lot of fun, that running for the final Champions League, well, the final two Champions League places.
Sid, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Sid Lowe, out in Spain. From Spain, we go to Germany, and this roundup from Archie Rintutt.
In the Bundesliga this weekend, it wasn't really the football that made the headlines, even if Bayern Munich moved 3 points clear of second place Leipzig, who drew 1-1 against Leverkusen on Sunday. I was at Hoffenheim against Bayern on Saturday, and Bayern won 6-0. But what made the headlines was what happened in the second half. The game was stopped in the second half by referee Christian Dingert after the Bayern fans, or Bayern ultras in the away end, unveiled a banner which said Dietmar Hopp, the Hoffenheim owner, remains a son of a whore. Now, this is following up on Borussia Mönchengladbach's protest that we mentioned on the podcast last weekend, and on the punishment that the Borussia Dortmund fans have had to take, with them banned from Hoffenheim away games for the next 2 years. Now, this is one of the things that the ultras were protesting against: collective punishment, something that the DFB, the German FA, had said that they would no longer do back in 2017. However, the ultras are saying that they've now gone back on that promise. What happened, though, in Hoffenheim after this banner went up was the game was stopped, and Bayern players and the coach Hansi Flick went over to the Bayern away end to try and get them to stop. The game restarted a few minutes later, and then it happened again. Another banner coming out against Hopp, and this time the game was stopped and the players were taken off in Hoffenheim. Scenes that we've not seen before in the Bundesliga. Now, this was following the three-step protocol that the German FA have tried to roll out for racism mainly, but they used it here. And the game did eventually get started again, but this time the players decided, of their own will, people will tell you, to not go for goal, to just pass it amongst themselves in a show of solidarity with Dietmar Hopp, the Hoffenheim owner, who was also warmly received by the rest of the crowd there and by Bayern chairman Karl-Heinz Rummenigge. But this is an issue that is going to run and run. This is about the ultras against the way that modern football is going. And I think that the ultras have been painted in too broad a brushstroke, I think it's fair to say. They stand up against racism, homophobia, for human rights in Qatar, and they even did a Holocaust choreo remembering the victims at Bayern just a few weeks ago. However, they have been talked down by nearly every sporting director that I've heard over the weekend, and it's going to be interesting to see what sanctions happen here. This is a watershed moment for German football.
Thank you, Archie. In Ligue 1, the top three all won. That's PSG top, Marseille 13 points behind in second, and Rennes another 8 points behind in third. Still 11 games to go at the moment. It's between Rennes and Lille for that third Champions League spot. Lille are 4 points behind with the game in hand. Rennes have never played in the Champions League before. They're one of only three teams to beat PSG in the league this season. Manager Julien Stéphane is just 39, moved up from reserves to take over in December 2018 when they were in 14th, led them to their first trophy in 48 years just 4 months later, beating PSG on penalties in the final of the Coupe de France, and is now flying high in Ligue 1. From France, we go to Italy and Nicky Bandini on another weekend where the fixture list has been decimated by the coronavirus.
Yes, just four games played this weekend, which is especially crazy when you consider that everything was still supposed to be going ahead as of Saturday morning. A decision had been taken on Thursday to go ahead and play all games in regions where coronavirus cases have been diagnosed behind closed doors, because those are the regions where mass public gatherings have been banned. But of course, there had been lobbying and wrangling all week, because one of those games was Juventus-Inter on Sunday night. So this announcement comes in from the league. It was announced also by the local authorities. It was confirmed on Thursday. And yes, you know, it is a bit mad, this idea of Juve-Inter, maybe the biggest edition of the Derby d'Italia for the best part of 20 years, to go ahead without fans. But that's where we were, because everyone agreed there was just no room on the calendar to postpone any more games. And then on Saturday, suddenly there was room to postpone games, and all of these games get cancelled. And then we have this very public back and forth between Beppe Marotta, who's the CEO of Inter and who used to do the same job at Juventus, and the league's president, Paolo Dapino. Marotta is saying, hey, you know, this hurts us. We've already postponed last week's game against Sampdoria, and, you know, maybe this was a really good time to play Juventus as well, because they were dreadful against Lyon. And Dapino is saying, look, we offered you the chance to play this game on Monday, actually, when Juventus would have been allowed in, because the ban on mass gatherings in Piedmont has now been lifted, but away fans would not be allowed to go because the ban on gatherings in Lombardy, which also prohibits people in Lombardy from going to away games, has been extended by another week. So the next thing you've got, Inter fans protesting outside league headquarters with banners saying there's another Calciopoli scandal, and you've got this mad situation where they're now talking about postponing the games from the weekend just gone to the weekend coming up, so Juventus to happen this weekend, or maybe not on the weekend but Monday, and then moving the games from this coming weekend that should have happened, so the notional 27th round of fixtures, all the way back to May, when the Coppa Italia final date is scheduled. And then you'd move the cup final back until after the Serie A season, except that by that point, it's not even clear if they'd be able to do it at Stadio Olimpico, which is where it would normally happen, because that's a Euro 2020 venue. So all of this is going on. Meanwhile, you've got lots of clubs who aren't Juventus or Inter who are tearing their hair out and saying, look, we were happy playing behind closed doors this weekend and not making this mess of the rest of the fixture list. So lots of anger and recrimination still to come. There's going to be an emergency league meeting on Wednesday of the league and clubs, which is when the actual decision about what's going to happen with the schedule will get made. So what I'm saying so far is been widely speculated, but it's not confirmed. In the meantime, fascinatingly, Lazio are now top of the league because their game did go ahead. They beat Bologna 2-0 with Luis Alberto, star of the show. So they might be the one team that sort of claimed an advantage out of all this. Atalanta also beat Lecce 7-2. Extraordinarily, that's the third time this season they've scored seven goals. They're up to 70 already on the campaign. Lazio also beat Cagliari 4-3 on Sunday, meaning that even though we had only two games that afternoon, we still got 16 goals out of them.
Thank you, Nicky. Now, IFAB met in Belfast. Lots of old white men in a room making decisions on the future of the rules of football. They will trial concussion substitutions. The Premier League is going to have more monitor checks next season. They'll be considering a daylight offside law change. They'll be changing the handball law to differentiate more clearly between the arm and the shoulder. There will now be the T-shirt line. Does that mean football teams will be wearing more sort of AFL style sort of singlet vests to say, look, I know that was the wrong way. They want to go long sleeve, don't they, to make your shoulder longer. Infantino said about VAR, people need to relax. There's only one league in the world today where the issues seem to be a big problem. That is the Premier League. So that's what IFAB did.
He's not wrong. Seems to work pretty well everywhere else.
I think there are still, I mean, Australia, there's still problems with it over there, definitely.
That's not really a league.
Hello to our Australian listeners and to my in-laws. In MLS, David Beckham watched Inter Miami in their first ever game away at Los Angeles FC. They lost 1-0, Carlos Vela scoring the goal. He must be about 120, mustn't he? The toughest debut possible, really, 2,700-mile away trip at LAFC, who did really well in MLS last year.
Is that to their own stadium or Los Angeles' stadium? They're playing in Fort Lauderdale, I think, on the next two seasons until their stadium is built in Miami.
I saw Gordon Ramsay was there supporting his pal David Beckham.
Well, he used to play for Rangers in his head, so maybe he could have got a game.
Now, an email from Martin Milband on Alan Pardew. Very much enjoying the podcast here in Amsterdam, even if the panel does seem to be largely made up of Mackems, he said. I don't know if you've been following the fortunes of Alan Pardew since he took over at Ado Den Haag. He's a rather modest record of 1-1, drawn 2 and lost 3. Their only win came at home against the side who were bottom. And since that was his first game, his influence over the result was arguably negligible. Under his stewardship, Ado Den Haag are now second bottom of the Eredivisie, 6 points adrift of safety. I asked a mate who supports them what he thinks of Pardew. His exact words were, high-backed air needs van, translated as, he's useless. Entertainingly, some Ado fans gate-crashed training recently, apparently in an attempt to show Pardew how to do tactics. They actually turned up with a tactics board, right? And they didn't like... It was sort of blown up a bit as if it was like they invaded. They all came down. It was very polite. And they had a chat to Pardew and Chris Powell, who's his assistant. But I love the idea of fans going with a tactics board, which is a step from when he first arrived. There was this huge tifo with Alan Pardew and Chris Powell as the Ghostbusters. It was
really
amazing,
chuffed,
wasn't it?
He'd got the job.
Not going so well now. And that'll do for today's podcast. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you, Max. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Barney.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.